The indignity of the lockup of massive amounts of federal lands in 1980 was combined with the embarrassment of all our dirty laundry being exposed in the book we're going to talk about today. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Alaskans love to talk about the pipeline days. It's nostalgic. Wilderness? Not so much. Our phone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call, 550-8422. Email talk@APRN.org. Our guest is Joe McGinnis, author of Going to Extremes on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Oh, yes, Joe McGinnis, the calls are already piling in here. How you doing?
Pretty well, Steve. Glad to be here.
I guess the whole world knows, or most of it knows, you've been living next door to the person that you're writing your next book about.
I have. That's been on Lake Lucille and Wasilla. And I would say that our interface has been non-existent. I've been there since the middle of May, and as I told her husband when he came over to ask me what I was doing there, I said, I'm going to be living here working on this book, but you're not going to see me any more than you want to, because I'm not the kind of neighbor who's intrusive.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, that you fit right in with that sort of attitude in Alaska.
Pretty much.
Okay, well, for those who don't know, Going to Extremes came out in about 1980, right? And it's a portrait. I guess you're now thinking of it as a time capsule, and it's the way I think of it too, of Alaska during those weird pipeline years. And it took you a while to write this, right? You got here in the mid-70s?
Yeah, I got out here the first time in the fall of 1975. And I was interested in seeing Alaska before Alaska as it had always existed disappeared, because it was pretty obvious that something as massive as the pipeline construction and everything that would follow when the oil began to flow through was going to make Alaska a very different place from what it had been before the discovery of Prudhoe Bay. So my concept was to look at the last days of the last frontier. And in many ways, that held up. I was here 75 through the fall of 76. I came back in the summer of 77. And then I went home and wrote the book, and it was published in 1980. And I think looking back and having been here for 4 months this summer, it's a very different place from what it was when I got here the first time. But those years happened to be very, very special kind of years, because that's when everything was actually happening. That's when the fur was flying, and all limits were there only to be exceeded. And it was a pretty wild and woolly place.
And you tried to portray that in the book. Was that a challenge?
Oh, no. All you have to do in Alaska is just get up out of bed in the morning and step outside and start talking to somebody, and that'll lead you to somebody else, and that'll lead you to somebody else. And by the end of the day, you've got 25 stories.
Well, did you stay interested in Alaska after? I mean, you went on to write Fatal Vision after this. It's a pretty well-known book about the Jeffrey McDonald murders and all that, and you got that's a whole other story. I don't know if we'll talk about that much or not, but you went on to a bunch of other things after your Alaska chapter. Did you maintain an interest in what was going on back here?
Oh, I always did, and I was always looking for an excuse to get back. The problem was that I'd have to write another book about Alaska, and for many years after Going to Extremes, people felt that between that book and John McPhee's Coming into the Country, Alaska had been pretty well portrayed, and there was nothing left to say about it. And it wasn't until the 50th anniversary of statehood that I came up with an idea for perhaps a new book about Alaska as it enters its second 50 years. And I wrote a 20-page proposal for that book focusing on Bill Allen and Vico and the Corrupt Bastards and all the other stuff that was going on at the 50-year mark. And one of the things I mentioned in one paragraph in that 20-page proposal was that there was now a woman governor of the state. And that's something you wouldn't have found 35 years ago. And that proposal was submitted to publishers about 6 weeks before John McCain changed history forever by reaching out for that woman governor and making it impossible to write any new book about Alaska that didn't focus on her.
Wow. And so there you are. All of a sudden, the book that you pitched was not the book that your publisher wanted.
Now the only thing anybody wants is a book about Sarah Palin.
So you've been up here how long now working on this?
I got here, I think, the second week in May, and I've been here except for a brief family visit outside in early August. I've been here ever since. Unfortunately, I have to go back home now and sit down and start to write. This part has been the fun part, but
I see. So you haven't I mean, obviously, take notes.
Oh, sure,
and notes, you maybe journal stuff,
and you organize them, and you know, you keep kind of a running commentary on what's going on, but. Writing is such a different kind of activity. It just uses a different part of the brain from going around talking to people. And it requires a level of concentration that you just can't sustain if you have an appointment at 3 o'clock tomorrow and 10 o'clock the next day. And it comes in two phases. First, you figure out what the story is going to be, and then you have to go home and tell it.
Have you figured out what the story is going to be? Yeah, I mean, you had this title, Sarah Palin's Year of Living Dangerously. Sounds like that's not going to work anymore.
Looks like it's going to be more than a year, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And the danger may not just be, maybe she's not the one living dangerously, maybe we are.
Yeah. So even that's got to change.
Everything changes in the writing, you know.
Well, we have a title suggested by a listener from Marie in Homer. Here's your suggestion, Going to Extremists.
Well,
not so bad, huh?
That's not bad at all. That's thank you, Marie. And I'm not surprised that came from Homer.
Well, I have to tell you, I'm just super pleased to have had the chance to meet you and to have an hour with you on the radio, sharing you with the people of Alaska, because you've been one of my heroes since your first book. And we're just about the same age, so I'm even more blown away that at that young age.
I think we have even the same birthday, don't we?
Pretty well. I'm January 5th.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm December 9th.
Yeah, so there we are. In between is Tony Knowles. So here you were with this unexpectedly successful book, The Selling of a President. And you had come out of Philadelphia. You already knew the now infamous, I will say, Roger Ailes, because he was producing the Mike Douglas Show while you were working for the newspaper there, right?
That's right. And I wanted to write a piece about Douglas because it was one of the few national shows being done, the only one being done out of Philadelphia. And Roger was the executive producer, and so I got to know Roger when I wrote that piece. And we got to be good friends, and we lived about 3 miles apart from each other outside Philadelphia. And when I hooked up with the Nixon campaign, the advertising portion of the campaign in 1968, the advertising director said to me one day, well, we've just hired this brilliant young TV director and producer out of Philadelphia, and he's going to direct all of Nixon's live shows. His name is Roger Ailes. And I said, oh, my God, because I knew how talented Roger was, but also that he was a bit of a... He wasn't necessarily just a team player. Roger did things his way, and he didn't like anyone to tell him that there was any other way to do things. And when Roger walked into the office and saw me there, he said, "What the hell is this?" He said, "What are you doing here?" Roger was aware from reading my columns in Philadelphia that I was certainly no fan of Richard Nixon. The Nixon people never bothered to read those columns. And I said, I said, Roger, please just don't rat me out. And he didn't.
he told Kerwin Swint in the book that Kerwin wrote about him, Dark Genius, that there's no way he would have allowed you to follow him around.
But it wasn't his decision to make. So he
put up with it, and he actually said, well, it's somebody else's problem.
Well, that book did Roger a lot of good, I have to say. Roger comes out as sort of the iconoclastic hero of that book, and it made him famous in a way he wouldn't have been if I hadn't written about him.
Well, but I don't know how you feel about it, but the portrayal in the book gave me the impression of somebody that totally remade somebody that badly needed remaking.
Well, that's right. And he did it successfully. And after that, everybody wanted the same treatment. George Bush I wanted Roger on his staff. You know, Roger worked with Republican presidential candidates in one capacity or another ever since.
Yeah. Now, it didn't really become an issue there. It later became an issue with Jeffrey McDonald. But the allegation was made that you had basically wormed your way into this campaign and then write a tell-all afterwards. You were part of the campaign, right?
Well, I called up and said I'd like to write a book about the advertising campaign. And I called the Democrats and the Republicans. I called the advertising agencies. Doyle Dane Birnbach was the Democratic advertising agency. And they said to me, are you crazy? You think we would let a guy hang around us and see all this inside stuff while it's going on? They said, no. Nixon's people said, well, that seems like an interesting idea. Sure, come on around. And there was no worming involved. I told them who I was. My record was there for anyone to see. I was actually writing anti-Nixon columns from the Republican convention in Miami in 1968, and the Philadelphia Inquirer was on sale in the hotel lobbies down there, and they just didn't care enough to bother to pick it up and read my column. So there was no worming was not exactly the operative term. It was a very forthright declaration that I'm here to write a book. And they said, well, we welcome this. And the only stipulation they made was that I not write anything until after the election. And I agreed to that. I said, I won't even start writing until after the election. And we just took it from there.
And Selling of the President comes out, and did you think of yourself as part of that wave of creative nonfiction writers at that time?
Well, I don't know. I just did my work and let other people kind of figure those things out. Mm. But there was an awful lot of great stuff being done then by people like Gay Talese and Marshall Frady. You know, David Halberstam was a little more orthodox in his approach, but Harper's Magazine, when Willie Morris was the editor back in the 60s, was really a lively, vibrant thing. There's just nothing remotely like it today.
Yeah. The one what always sticks with me is in the mid-60s in the Herald Trib and Tom Wolfe.
Wolfe and my great old friend Jimmy Breslin.
Yeah. 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 And there was something was happening. You just kind of knew from reading that I've never seen anything quite like that before.
Well, the society was changing. And there were a lot of young, Pete Hamill's another one to mention, a lot of talented young journalists who were not satisfied with doing things the old way. I think we recognized, and I include myself in their company with some trepidation, but we recognized that it's possible to write nonfiction the way fiction had been written. You can tell stories. They happen to be true stories, but it doesn't have to be this old-fashioned newspaper approach of A, B, C, and then you're Nutcraft, and then you're this, and then you're that. You could be as creative in nonfiction as any novelist in the country.
Do you keep up on what is written in Alaska, about Alaska, or any of that? Have you?
You know, to a degree. I certainly haven't read everything.
Yeah, we've done shows on this. I mean, it's my contention that we haven't even scratched the surface yet, and what the white people in Alaska have yet to write. That you know, there's just plenty coming.
Seth Kantner's Ordinary Wolves is a wonderful book. Which
I think that may be the best
recommend.
Of the bunch.
Well, then there's the new one, Legends of a Suicide by David Vann. And that's just awesome. That's just a mind-blowing book. He's going to be here, you know, at Metro Books next Thursday. I shouldn't promote him because I'm going to be at Barnes & Noble the same time he's at Metro, like 3 blocks away. But we're going to get together for a drink or a cup of coffee or something before or after our respective signings.
Great.
That book I read earlier this summer, and it's stunning.
What's the title again?
Legends of a Suicide. That's about his father, who was a dentist in Ketchikan in Fairbanks, who killed himself. And Van writes about, and he writes in a wildly experimental way, about his attempt to make sense of this and to come to terms with it. And it's just an unforgettable portrait of sections of Alaska and of the human condition.
Our guest is Joe McGinnis. He's author of Going to Extremes. And our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. Maybe you were connected with Joe way back when, 30 years ago, more than that, really, and want to reconnect, or maybe you want to make him aware of something that would pertain to the book he's working on now about Sarah Palin. He's only in the state for a short time after this. He's got a book signing, and he's be leaving town, what, the end of the week?
Yes, I'm flying out Sunday night, the way it looks right now.
Ooh. If it's a local call from Anchorage at 550-8422, statewide, 1-800-478-8255. Email is talk@aprn.org. I am thinking that the Alaska that you saw in the mid-1970s, that you thought you were writing about the Alaska that was passing, and I suppose in a sense you were, but what's sticking with me is the Alaska that kind of stuck, you know, the kind of continued.
Yeah.
I mean, we have maybe a little bit more of it than we really should. I mean, I guess I would say the Vico thing is one example.
Yes. You know, before there was oil, it was a pretty tough place to make a living up here, and the people who were trying to carve that living out of conditions that were a lot more primitive then than they are now in terms of road system, sewers, septic, any of the conveniences of modern life, communications. They were a particular breed of people, politically probably libertarian, but certainly not orthodox right-wing, not what you would call Tea Party type people today. But then the oil came and the money came with it. And all of a sudden, from having almost no money, the state was just awash in money. And except for that terrible recession, depression in the 80s when the price of oil dropped to $10 a barrel, Alaska has stayed pretty well awash in money ever since. And now people who have been drawn to it subsequent to the pipeline may not necessarily be the same kind of people who came out here in the 40s and 50s and 60s.
During the time you've been here working on this new book, have you heard, have people wanted to bend your ear with conspiracy theories?
Oh, sure.
All right. Oh, sure. See, that's Alaska.
They want to bend both my ears, you know. And, there's more conspiracies, my goodness, you know. We can take it all the way back to Chuck Heath's role in the Kennedy assassination.
You know? Oh, boy. Well, of course, you know that Hale Boggs was, who died in the plane crash, you know, he was on the Warren Commission.
Well, that's right. Yeah, and now Nick Begich's son, Mark, is now a U.S. senator. Do you think that's a coincidence?
1-800-478-8255. Our guest, Joe McGinnis. Joe, I think you were born not too far from the Blarney Stone.
I was born in Midtown Manhattan, New York City.
Really?
Yes, indeed.
Really?
Yes.
Well,
my grandfather was a New York City fireman.
How did you end up working for a newspaper in Worcester?
I went to college in Worcester. And when I...
There was a job.
When I graduated, they said, if you're willing to stay here, instead of paying to be in Worcester, you can get paid to be in Worcester. I got paid $93 a week when I started. The salary was $90 a week, but because I worked nights, I got an extra $3.
Did you get to know Boston as well? I assume you did.
I did get to know Boston. My father actually was born in the suburbs of Boston, and I had a lot of relatives. I knew both Boston and New York from my earliest days, long before I ever started to work.
Yeah. So when did you move to Philadelphia?
1965. I got a job offer from the Philadelphia Bulletin, which was a step up from the Worcester Telegram, although I had great times. And one of my friends at the Worcester Telegram, a reporter there, was named Tom Brennan. And in the 1960s, he and his wife, Marnie, set out for Alaska towing a houseboat on wheels. And that pretty much makes up the first or second chapter going to extremes. And Tom and Marnie, you're still here. I've seen them several times this summer. And they came out to see what it was like. And 46 years later, they're still here and real Alaskans. But Philadelphia, moved from one paper to the other, started writing a newspaper column, went to Vietnam to write about that, covered some of the 68 campaign. That was a terrible spring. I was at both the Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy funerals, and some bad stuff was going on then. And out of it came Richard Nixon's candidacy, and I saw the opportunity to take a look at that in a way that people hadn't looked at it before. Advertising was coming into its own. Advertising was going to have a large part to play in the 68 election in ways that it never had before. And Richard Nixon, who had been a kind of a rotten tomato of a product, you know, had to be repackaged in shiny new paper.
Joe McGinnis is our guest, and starting with the calls, here is Vic in Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Vic.
Good morning. Speaking of extremes, Alaska has what some people consider to be an extreme predator control program going on, and Sarah Palin was very strongly supportive of that. In fact, she's still kind of the butt of late-night talk show hosts' jokes about shooting wolves out of helicopters. And I was just wondering if in the book you will be dealing at all with Sarah Palin and predator control.
Oh, I think I'll touch upon that because it's one of many areas where her point of view has become, well, when she was governor, her point of view became policy in many ways. And she's still, you know, she's still a very active force.
Vic?
Yes. Well, it certainly, her term, brief as it was, carried on Frank Murkowski's push for widespread predator control that now extends over a big area of the state. And it's highly controversial. You know, we've had initiatives on it here several times to try to block aerial shooting and the politics of the wolf control issue is pretty interesting in itself, the whole history of it, going back quite a ways.
It is indeed in the land conservation battles and many other ways. And I think really it's kind of an identity issue for Alaskans. Joe, you probably see that.
Well, I do. You know, in the 70s, there was a lot less talk about predator control. I mean, predators were part of the food chain. It was just part of the natural ecology. And this business of trying to reduce one species to increase another, you know, when man starts to interfere with what nature has taken care of all along, generally it leads to, it makes things worse, not better.
Vic, you probably agree with that.
I do agree to an extent, although everybody recognizes that there are some rare occasions when you know, for subsistence reasons or otherwise, predator control is necessary. But, you know, if you look at what has happened in the last several years, including under Palin's administration, now we've got these extremely controversial and over-the-top methods, you know, where we're shooting sows with cubs in the case of bears, and we're poisoning wolf pups and dens, and we've got 100 private pilots out there shooting wolves. I mean, many people who would ordinarily support occasional predator control think that this stuff is way over the top.
And might just be a little embarrassing, seen from outside. Yeah, all right, Vic. I want to thank you for your call.
Thank you.
All right, our guest, Joe McGinnis, author of Going to Extremes. And he's live and ready to talk to you on the telephone, on the radio, statewide, on Talk of Alaska. We'll go to Shelley next, joins the program from Delta. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Joe McGinnis, Shelley.
Thank you. Hi. Yeah, I ever since Sarah Palin first stepped on the national stage, she was, in my, not only my opinion, but others, spreading lies by saying she said no to earmarks, which she accepted. She said she was exonerated from her abuse of office, which she was actually found to have abused her office. accusing Obama of palling around with terrorists, and, you know, the list goes on. But yet her ardent supporters talk about what they love about her is she's so honest, she's so real. And I wondered if you gained any insights into that, what I would think is a huge discrepancy.
Well, Shelley, here's the position I'm in right now. I haven't written the book yet, and I really don't feel comfortable talking about Sarah Palin before I write the book. Once it's written, once it's published about a year from now, I hope to be back, and then I'll gladly talk all day and half the night about her. But
okay.
I just never felt comfortable talking about any book before I've written it.
Oh, okay. Well, but is that something you have looked for in your interviews, any insight into her
well,
fans?
Well, I don't think she didn't want to talk to you, right?
No. Yeah. I've spoken to Todd, but but not to her.
And, no, I meant talking to the people who are just, her ardent fans.
I've spoken to quite a few of those, and I've spoken to quite a few people who are her ardent enemies. And I have to go home now and make sense out of all this and come up and tell the story that will be true, and I hope very enlightening for a lot of people.
Okay, great. I'll look forward to your book.
Thanks, Shelley.
Yeah, Shelley, it's got me scratching my head, too. Let's go to Homer and Linda Ann, or is it Lindy Ann?
It's Lindy Ann.
Hello, Lindy Ann. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Joe McGinnis.
Thank you very much. Joe McGinnis, I was also born in Midtown Manhattan. Lindy Ann Sarno was my maiden name. And I made the journey all the way out to the West Coast to become a homesteading woman who lives in harmony with nature. Homesteading people and Native people are the people that I learned from. They're my heroes. And my husband was born in Fairbanks while Alaska was still a territory. So he grew up in nature also in the most Alaskan extreme way. For both of us, he also worked on the pipeline, by the way, both of us, subsistence is the issue. And we wanted to ask you, how will you handle this key and heartfelt issue of subsistence as it relates to the political groups around Sarah Palin?
Well, I don't think that Sarah Palin has been a very strong advocate for maintaining subsistence lifestyle in Alaska. I think she's opted more on the side of developments, and if subsistence was a fine thing back in the past, but it doesn't seem to me that she has much of a commitment to maintaining that. And despite the fact that she's married to a man who is part Native, and that culture goes way back, certainly you would know better than I from having been here longer and more consistently, but I see very little evidence that she's ever spoken in a heartfelt way about the need to continue with the subsistence lifestyle, and that importance, the importance of subsistence to the Alaskan culture. I think she's more sort of along the Joe Miller lines of, let's make English the official language of the state, and these Native people, just because they got here first, that doesn't mean that they should get to control everything.
Well, thank you for making that clear. Thank you. Thank you very much.
And, all right.
Perhaps we could be in contact later and exchange more correspondence on these matters.
I hope so.
Thank you.
All right, Lindy Ann from Homer. It is Talk of Alaska. Joe McGinnis is our guest. It strikes me, Mr. McGinnis, that you're a little bit of a soft target now because you're almost done with your research and people can sort of put the last impressions on you during this show.
Well, this is what I'm going to take away with me, Steve.
It's Talk of Alaska. The telephone number 1-800-478-8255, and we'll come back to you as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a pre-existing medical condition, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the new temporary federal insurance program being administered by ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The program is for those with qualifying pre-existing conditions and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months. Talk to an independent insurance broker or go online to achia.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
Our guest is Joe McGinnis. He's finishing up his research on his new book, but he has also consented to the republication of Going to Extremes 30 years after it came out.
Steve, I not only consented to it, I advocated it and instigated it, yeah.
And so Epicenter Press has put this out, and it's in the bookstores, and it's got this great picture of the Malamute Saloon on the front. Why'd you pick that?
I didn't pick it. I leave that to the publisher. But I just, the last time I was in Fairbanks, heading for Fairbanks a few weeks ago, I stopped by Esther to take a close-up look at the Malamute Saloon, and it looks exactly as it does there on the cover. Unfortunately, it was closed, but...
Unfortunately. And so I'm delighted to have Joe McGinnis to share with the people of Alaska on this show, and I got a lot of questions of my own, and you're welcome to join at 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at aprn.org, and from Talkeetna, which you also wrote about, we have Tom, who says, I say combine the titles, Going to Extremists, Sarah Palin's Year of Living Dangerously. Ha! Will Joe ever write another great book about a sports team like the Miracle of Castel de Sangro?
I'd like to. And I appreciate the good review for that book. That was my year in Italy with a minor league soccer team, and it had a lot to do with a lot more than soccer. I got to say, if anybody's thinking of going to Italy, maybe they want to look at the Miracle of Castel de Sangro. Just as I said 35 years ago to people, if you read Going to Extremes and you still want to move to Alaska, you're going to do just fine up there. But if you read it and you think, uh-oh, that's not the kind of place I'm sure I should be, then you might as well not go.
Whoa. I think that's good advice. I'm not sure what it means, but I think it's good advice.
Well, if you get scared away by some of the...
The bear stuff.
Pictures of the bear stuff or yeah. Some of the the people stuff.
Well, let me bring up that bear stuff because that's interesting. The way you end this book, basically, in the same place as another one of the great books about Alaska, Bob Marshall. Up in the Brooks Ranch. And you actually, to take it even further, Bob Marshall is always trying to get up to this pass. And there you are with your typical way of ingratiating yourself with the people that can get you on great trips. And you've got these Park Service people before the Alaska Lands Act is passed, and they want to take a hike in Gates of the Arctic National Park to prospect out what kind of great visitor experience there might be and so forth like that. And you get to go along on this. Unfortunately, you're in shape to do that rather stringent hike. And you managed to get to the other side of the pass that Marshall could never get to. And he was one of the great hikers ever.
Well, it wasn't a question of his lack of endurance. I think, there's a lot of factors like supplies and weather. And, we set out with a specific purpose, which was to get up to Cocktot Mountain. And we managed to do that. And we got through that pass. It was a wonderful, that's the Arctic Divide. And it was a terrific experience being on both sides of that. But the Park Service administrator, John Kaufman, who organized that trip and who went on it, I said, what are we thinking about bears here? Because we're not carrying, can't carry firearms in a national park. Then you couldn't. And John said, well, no, there's no concern about bears because up that far north, the habitat is so sparse that it's roughly a 100 square mile habitat for any individual grizzly bear. And after we had 12 encounters in 13 days, I said to John, well, we must have just been walking along the border of those habitats every step of the way.
Well, yeah, you know, habitat probably consists mostly of the river anyway.
I got to say that I think without fear of contradiction, I can say that I've been a lot closer to a mama grizzly and her cubs than the ex-governor, Sarah Palin, ever has been.
Hmm.
Much too close.
Well, you know, of course, we have these... Vic has brought up this business of game management as a fascinating issue in Alaska, and it's got a fascinating future probably. But it used to be that there were just a couple of places in the state where the brown bears were, I'll go ahead and say habituated, although the people will hate me for saying that. But nonetheless, that nobody hunts them, nobody threatens them, and if human beings act as if they're a neutral part of the environment, the bear really doesn't really care that much about them. You can get really close at a place like McNeil or Anand.
Well, yeah, also in the Brooks Range, I think every single bear that we saw had never seen a human being before.
Yeah.
And there was no reason for the bear to fear us or feel threatened by us. The one really hairy encounter was the one with the two cubs, because a mother grizzly doesn't have to be mean-spirited to want to protect her cubs, as we've heard repeatedly in the past several months. But these cubs, fortunately, took one look at the four of us, five of us, and ran across a creek and up a hill, and she followed them, and we were able to proceed.
Our guest is Joe McGinnis, author of Going to Extremes, and it has been republished and available in bookstores. He's signing in on Thursday night in Anchorage at where? Barnes & Noble?
Barnes & Noble. Okay. 6 o'clock, yeah.
And we got a call from Juno, where this is going to be, I think, on TV on Sunday. But you're not going to Juno, right?
I've been there before. I wish I could get back, but I've just run out of time.
Joe and Juno, welcome to Talk of Alaska with Joe McGinnis.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning, Joe McGinnis.
Good morning.
You are a longtime observer of Alaska, Joe McGinnis, and you've knocked around various states and countries and everything. And I think the easy analysis is some of the horror stories that have come out of Alaska in the past 30 years because of our oil wealth. But my question to you, what are your observations about what's gone right and what are some things that are positive, or that, you know, what's our future look like? You know, look at our crystal ball and project some good things that are happening or might happen or not.
Well, I think Alaska's future economically is still so closely tied to the price of oil that for the longer term and a brighter future, it seems that maybe it's time to lessen that dependence and to try to find ways to develop an economy that has more sources of strength than simply energy production, because the pipeline is now down to, what, one-third of its peak capacity, and it's dwindling ever further. In 10 years, Prudhoe Bay will be dry, and by then, Alaska should have in place something to pick up that economic slack. I think the greatest thing about Alaska still, and I know this from having experienced it when I was here last fall, and again all spring and summer this year, is the people. Because the people, they didn't all come out to be homesteaders anymore, and more and more of them have actually been born here, white people. And it's still got the greatest, the people have the greatest spirit, the greatest unselfish, giving, natural warmth of any people I've ever encountered anywhere.
And I think also there's a cross-cultural future in Alaska, not just Alaska Native and the people that subsequently come, but the people that subsequently came after that.
Well, sure. Look at the Samoan population in Anchorage now, and the more and more Asians. And, you know, ideally, if you look 20, 25 years down the road, Anchorage could be a city much more like Vancouver, where you have a great cross-cultural mix, and that provides energy, it provides all sorts of opportunity, that kind of diversity. So the further that Alaska gets away from the hard-bitten sourdough being the only kind of white person that lives here, and the Indian or Eskimo being the only kind of dark-skinned person that lives here, I think the brighter Alaska's future will be.
If you were consulting with a tourism company, let's say, What direction would you counsel them to plan? What sort of future in Alaska would you have them plan for? Would you suggest that they plan for?
Well, it depends who their clientele are.
Clientele to pitch for? I mean, it's very interesting. We had this massive cruise ship dependency, and the cruise ships have been pulling out lately. Partly that's fuel costs, partly the recession, a number of reasons. Some of them blame it on overregulation.
There's still an awful lot of cruise ship buses running up and down the Parks Highway.
Massive. But what is odd is that even with the drop in cruise ship visitation for South Central Alaska, tourism's actually up. In other words, there are more independent travelers or small tours and other ways that people are getting here.
And that's such a better experience, is to do it by yourself or with a small group than as part of a large group where you're taken off a ship and put onto a bus and taken to a cruise ship hotel. Everything is homogenized and laid out for you. And sure, you could take some pictures of mountains and stuff, but you don't really get a feel for Alaska. You know, get in the camper, get in your car, two or three friends, four people, go off someplace, go as far as the road can take you, and stop whenever you want to. That's what Alaska gives you best. You know, Alaska is a place that it's there waiting to be discovered. You just have to make a little bit of effort.
It's all over the place.
That's right.
It's all around Anchorage. No matter which direction you go.
There's a whole lot of it.
Yeah, Alaska. Tom and Talkeetna had a couple other comments here. He says, how about a book on Spanish bullfighters? And also, please, consider that book on O.J. Maybe you could interview him in prison.
Well, I spent 10 months of my life watching the O.J. Simpson trial from a seat in the front row that Judge Ito was nice enough to give me. And after that jury came back in 2.5 hours with that verdict, it was obvious to me that everything that had gone on for those 10 months had been a farce. As soon as that jury was selected in central L.A., and it was 11 blacks and one Hispanic on the jury, there was no way that O.J. Simpson could be convicted on the testimony of white LAPD officers.
Whoa. No interest in that book.
No, I tried for 3 or 4 months to write that book, and I found I had nothing new to say. I had nothing that I wanted, nothing to say about it. And so I gave back that money, and I went off to Italy and spent my year with the minor league soccer team for Castel de Sangro.
That's inspirational.
Well, it might have been a big mistake, too. It's inspirational if you have a trust fund, but if you're trying to, it's not a good idea for a writer to give back money.
I guess not. Well, Lee, speaking of that, I mean, you had to give a hefty hunk of money to Jeffrey McDonald. That must have really hurt.
I didn't give him a penny.
No?
No, not a penny.
Okay, I thought that was settled for...
No. That was settled by my publisher's insurance company. In fact, it cost McDonald quite a bit of money for that settlement because he wound up... losing it all in a state court suit brought by Freddie Kassab under the California Son of Sam law. And all that got taken away from him. I didn't give him a dime. I would never have given him a dime. The insurance company made the decision after a seven-week trial of that with the hung jury that they didn't want to go through it all again. And that was not my call. That's something that I had nothing to do with me.
I'll have to say that I haven't read that book. And I hesitate to broach the subject because I enjoy the way that you treat things in your writing. And
you should read that book, Steve.
I think maybe I should. But I'm wondering if you could tell me if you feel that you really got what was there to be got.
Probably more in that book than any other book I've ever written.
Hmm. Yeah. Because we're talking, I guess, zeitgeist, for lack of a better expression. Do you think you'll get a little zeitgeist in this book that you're working on now?
I think however many people were at the Glenn Beck, Sarah Palin rally in Washington last week were a sign of how central she is to the zeitgeist today. And I see no reason to think she'll be any less central a year from now.
Let's go to Pam, joins the program from Fairbanks. You're on the air with Joe McGinnis.
Hi, Joe. It's good to hear you on the radio in Alaska. I guess I'm going to say these things in order. In 68, when I was back in Ohio still, we read your book, The Selling of the President. We were so glad to read it. We were educated, and we loved that book. And then in the 70s, I met you when you were in Fairbanks. And then when Going to Extremes came out, you were interviewed on the Dukavich Show. And as I remember, it was it was aired in 2 half-an-hour portions. And people in Fairbanks were livid at the book, and they made the local public TV station air those interviews again a week later so that everyone could watch them. And they were livid, I think, because you just spent a short time here. You talked about the ice fog. I think you went upstairs into an Alyeska office where they were eating donuts or something. And probably we just didn't feel like we got our fair shake. Anyhow, I loved that book. And I just thought you probably didn't know that reaction had happened. And it was because they were interested and because they read it. I also want to throw a couple other things in here. I went to the Palin disinaugural when she... when Parnell was sworn in as governor, which was in Fairbanks, and the crowd was military. From my 37-year resident eye, the crowd at Alaska Land here for that was military and people from out of state. There were people from out of state and tourists. And they were, they had the crazy look in their eye. They were not nice people, the military people, but especially the people from out of town. I just congratulate you on your writing. We love your writing. And also, perhaps you would consider writing a book on national history. I don't know where one travels to focus on that. But
on what?
We have a new subject, the national history. We have a new subject here. Now we have Joe Miller. We have the change of the socio-political culture. I think it's a very serious change. You mentioned Glenn Beck. I think you might know what I'm alluding to. The focus that you brought to the 68 race was really educational, and I was so glad to read that. And I also want to throw in a comment about Bob Marshall and that book, Arctic Village. You know, he wrote about how compliant, how welcoming the Native people were, and especially on the issue of their women and those habits. And I must say that Native women here take issue very much with that these days. We're older and more mature. No one ever mentions the 400 gallons of alcohol that he also shipped in there, or not he, but that the people shipped in for the winter, so that might have had something to do with that. I hate to end on a negative note here. I love your writing. You're a great writer.
Thanks so much.
Uh-huh. All right, Pam, thank you for that call from Fairbanks and for bringing up that blast from the past. Are you getting a backwash from that? Because that was intense at the time.
It was intense at the time, and what's been very interesting about this republication is to see the absence of that kind of indignation. I think,
I guess the people that are PO'd are not the ones that are going to come up to
you. Oh, yeah, they can if they want to, but they haven't.
Well, you're a big guy.
The thing is, I'm an old man. I'm a senior citizen. I'm on Medicare, The thing is, Steve, that Going to Extremes is probably the first irreverent book ever written about Alaska. The first book that didn't sort of take a worshipful attitude about the great land. Certainly that's a big part of it. That chapter at the end in the Brooks Range, certainly Alaska captivated me, and I've loved it forever. But there were other aspects to life in Alaska that the tourist brochures had never focused on. And my book did, at least in the early part. And a lot of people who were not written about, the people who I wrote about, really, by and large, had no complaints at all. It was, in fact, there were some people whose names I changed that complained that I changed their names. They wanted their real names in the book. It's the people who I didn't write about that took some exception to it. But I think it's wonderful that if they hated a TV show so much that they forced the station to air it again just so they could get angry all over again the next week. I think that's pretty good marketing.
It's Talk of Alaska. Our guest is Joe McGinnis's Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
Email is talk@aprn.org, and Kathleen in Girdwood sends this one. Joe McGinnis, thank you for writing Going to Extremes. 30 years ago, my father read this book, a gift from me, and he finally realized why his fresh-faced 21-year-old daughter would move from the safe Chicago suburbs to Alaska. I'm still here, still love it, and just bought a place in Girdwood. I hope to see you at the book signing, Kathleen.
Kathleen, I look forward to it. It's not a long drive up from Girdwood, and it's a very pretty drive, and I hope you're able to make it.
One of the great drives in the world.
Absolutely.
Let's go to Bethel now. And Anila, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Hello.
Thank you to Joe's. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question for Mr. McGinnis. Good morning, Mr. McGinnis. Sarah Palin wanted to drill in Anwar. And it's a national wildlife refuge, and she proposed the AGEA program down to the lower 48. And there's mixed talk about having to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and possibly hurting the porcupine herd. And the talk was that if it was the pipeline was in state, that we would be making more money than having to ship it down to the lower 48. And what's your take on that?
Well, actually, the first time I came back in 2008 was to write a piece about AGEA. I wrote a story that was the cover story on Condé Nast Portfolio magazine. And the title that they put on the cover was Pipe Dreams. And that pretty much summarized my view of AGEA. I talked to a lot of people, including Marty Rutherford, Pat Galvin, some of the architects of AGEA. Governor Palin, of course, was too busy to speak to me herself, but her people did. And I talked to people on both sides of that and came to the conclusion that AGEA is just going to cost the state $500 million and not really accomplish anything. If a gas pipeline does get built, it'll be despite and not because of AGEA. As far as Anwar, well, you know, that's really a separate issue, but it seems pretty consistent that the Palin view is drill anywhere and everywhere as often as possible, and if you're not drilling for oil, then go out and start mining for copper, gold, and zinc, and as much as you can find. The earth is there to yield up its treasures to man so we can improve our materialistic standard of living. And if you believe that the earth is in its final days anyway, and that Jesus is about to come back to America, as many of Sarah Palin's co-religionists believe, well, then why do you have to care about the environment? Because in, you know, 20 or 30 years, it's not going to be here.
Well, I've never been a Sarah Palin fan anyways from the very start. That, and on top of that, she's a quitter on just about everything she starts.
Okay, thanks for your call from Bethel. Hi. Our guest is Joe McGinnis, author of Going to Extremes, and Ingrid in the Homer area wants to be sure you're aware of the Koch brothers' presence in Alaska, which I would assume you would.
Yes, I'm aware of that. I'm aware of their presence pretty much all over the country, but certainly in Alaska. That's a terrific story by Jane Mayer in the recent New Yorker magazine that details the influence of these Texas billionaires over our political process. And I think it's something that they're the bankroll behind the Tea Party, and certainly a big part of the bankroll behind any kind of Sarah Palin national ambitions. And I think it's important to link these right-wing extremists with the big money that funds them and not look at them as the representatives of the little man, of the small man. This isn't populism. This is rampant capitalism.
Joel, you'll want to know that we just got an email from Jack A. Bear. He didn't really want to come on the show, but he says he leaves his phone number and everything, and I will pass that to you, and I know he's in your book.
Yes.
And he wants to talk to you.
Oh, good. There's nobody I'd rather talk to than Jack. He's great. He's great. He's just great.
He's a great guest on the show, too. I wish he had called.
Why didn't he come on today?
I don't know. He just emailed, his keys, working on a project. I don't know. You'll find out.
Okay.
Okay, Glenn joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Joe McGinnis.
Good morning, Mr. McGinnis. This is my second trip to Alaska. I'm a resident of Florida, and I try to come up and spend extended periods of time. And the reason I'm calling is I don't want to get involved with the Sarah controversy, But basically, have you had any experiences here with the Christian fundamentalist churches that, in my mind, have basically turned into political action committees? The Constitution affords us freedom from religion because the government can't institute religion, but yet we are subsidizing Christian fundamentalist churches. And I think the last election that was here, many of the young people that I talked to who were on the street corners were actively recruited by their political action committee churches. So I'm a Christian, and I'm incensed at the fact that Alaskans and others in this country have turned Christian churches into political action committees. I just wondering if you had any experience with that here. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your call.
I am aware of it.
I bet you are.
It didn't just start yesterday either. It's certainly in the Wasilla area in the valley. It's been going on, going back to the early 90s with the fight over trying to ban abortion from the Valley Hospital, despite the fact that it was constitutional. And going back really even further, the Christian right nationally has been trying to influence the political process, at least since the heyday of Pat Robertson. And in Alaska now, with all the different churches, the small churches, the different Christian denominations, they certainly are an active and a potent, very, very potent political force.
I was shocked very shortly after getting here in 1982, in the middle of the winter and a big snowstorm, there was a public hearing at a local high school about imposing some regulation on church-run preschools. And boy, did they ever show for that. I said, wow, this is a political force. That was 1982.
Yes. Well, it's no less a force now.
Oh, no, it's far more. This one from Liz in Fairbanks says, hey, I'm seeing some comparisons between the 68 election, which happened after the swath of assassinations in the 60s, and the ensuing political aftermath, and today's political ugliness. Are we seeing the shock doctrine yet again, Joe McGrinnis?
Well, let's hope the word assassination never comes into our conversation because, you know, there is a lot of talk about, that very, very thinly disguised threats of violence going on. And that would be a step right back into the cesspool that America threatened to become in the late 60s.
So what kind of environment do you go back to write in now, Joe?
I go back to an environment, a wooded environment with coyotes coming out to eat the apples that fall from our tree, thousands of acres of woodland, protected woodland right behind our house. And
Massachusetts, right?
Massachusetts, 2 hours west of Boston, no cell phone service at the house. That's what kind of wilderness it is back there.
Well, if you see Arlo Guthrie, say hi for me.
Sure will.
All right. Joe McGinnis has been our guest. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed. The Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance has a simple request. If you smoke, take it outside. Smoking hurts more than just you. Secondhand smoke increases the risk of coronary heart disease and kills nearly 50,000 non-smoking Americans every year. Smoking around your kids causes chronic and life-threatening diseases and is linked to sudden infant death syndrome. If you choose to smoke, make a choice that protects others who don't. Take it outside. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.